From the studios of WEKU on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, this is Eastern Standard. Hello, I'm John Hingsbergen. June is National Cancer Survivors Month, and despite efforts made regionally, the Bluegrass State still ranks number one in the nation in terms of cancer-related deaths. What's behind that troubling statistic? What is life like for cancer sufferers, those who suffer from cancer and survivors? And are you at risk? We're going to meet a survivor during today's program, as well as discuss this issue with experts. We want to hear from you and welcome your stories, questions, and comments for our guests. But we invite you to do that now by email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. You can post on our Facebook page, and we'll keep an eye on that and hopefully catch your comment and acknowledge it if you do so. Or you can send us a tweet at WEKUEST. In a little while, we'll open the phones and hopefully hear your voice on today's program. This is Eastern Standard. And joining us by telephone, first of all, let's welcome Dr. Thomas Tucker. Dr. Tucker is a PhD, MPH, Master of Public Health, founding chair of the Department of Epidemiology at the University of Kentucky's College of Public Health. Dr. Tucker is also the Associate Director for Cancer Control, Senior Director for Cancer Surveillance at the Markey Cancer Center, and the Director of the Kentucky Cancer Registry. In addition to numerous other positions held, he has over 40 years' experience in cancer surveillance and cancer control research. Dr. Thomas Tucker, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm going to come back to Dr. Tucker in just a few moments after I introduce Judy Hewlett. Judy is Executive Director of Friend for Life, a Kentucky-based nonprofit established in 1988. It pairs those who have been recently diagnosed with cancer with trained survivors of a similar experience so they can face their cancer diagnosis, treatment, and recovery with someone who can relate closely to them. A cancer survivor herself, Judy is has been a member of Consumer Advocates in Cancer Research and Related Activities since 2005. Judy, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, John.
And also with us another cancer survivor, Patsy Catlett. Patsy is a 16-year survivor of stage 3 lung cancer and is a volunteer with Friend for Life. And Patsy, in terms of other background, are you from the Louisville area?
I am.
Thanks for both of you for making the trip over for this morning's program. We're going to meet Patsy and Judy here in just a few minutes after we chat a bit with Dr. Tucker. And Dr. Tucker, I understand that you're an expert in a number of these issues, not a medical doctor, but a PhD, meaning you've done tons of research and very knowledgeable about these issues. Let's talk specifically about the nature of cancer and as a disease. And most of us have grown up knowing about cancer. We've known people who've experienced cancer in their lives. How is cancer today perceived? Is it still perceived as an incurable disease that once one gets that diagnosis, it's a very almost terminal diagnosis?
Absolutely not. We have made enormous strides forward in the past several decades, and there are many forms of cancer that we can treat very effectively. Particularly if we're successful in finding the disease early, we believe we can cure a large proportion of the people who unfortunately succumb to this disease.
I mean, it's almost a cliche that we talk about working to come up with a cure for cancer. Is that still a goal in the medical field? It sounds like we have a cure or apparently approaches that cure certain cancers.
This is the most probably important thing I'll say all day. Cancer isn't one disease. It's a set of different diseases that we classify together where your cells in particular sites or organs have been altered, the genetic structure of them have been altered, and they reproduce without control. Those cells don't die in a normal pattern like normal cells do. So each cancer, each site of cancer, be it lung cancer, breast cancer, colon cancer, has different things that cause it and different things to treat it, a different course of the disease. So it's really not one disease. In many of these cancers, particularly some of the more common ones, if we find it early, we have some very effective treatments. And by being able to more effectively target the right treatments based on genetic structures. At the end of the day, all of these are genetic changes. All cancers are. So, being able to target more effectively the treatments, we can actually make a huge difference. So instead of thinking about a cure for cancer, think about cures for specific types of cancer.
Okay, that is very helpful. We will not find a pill or something like an antibiotic that's going to be applicable to all kinds of cancers.
Unlikely.
How has the treatment and how have survival rates changed during your career of at least the past four decades?
Well, I'm going to make one more pitch, and that pitch is a public health pitch. If you look carefully at the data, the most effective things we have been able to do in changing the outcome in the population, that means cancer incidence, mortality, and survival rates, is the ability to detect the disease early. And so while treatments have made an enormous difference, particularly in diseases like breast cancer, in diseases like colorectal cancer, we have pretty effective treatments if we find it early. And in fact, our screening mechanisms can identify precancerous disease, which we can remove. These are polyps that can be removed at the time that a patient has colonoscopy, and that can prevent them from ever having cancer. So we can actually prevent the disease from occurring. We've had a major effort in the state with all of the major actors, the American Cancer Society, the public health departments, the two major universities, many, many other organizations coming together to focus on colorectal cancer. And we've been able, through that mechanism alone, to reduce the incidence in this state by 25%.
Wow.
That's a remarkable change in a reasonably short period of time. No other state had that dramatic a change in that short a period of time. And that's just being able to get more people, age-appropriate people, screened for colorectal cancer.
But in the meantime, Kentucky remains ranked number one in cancer-related deaths in the nation. Why?
I think that's a great question. So when we look, let's look, for example, at a different site. Lung cancer, we have the highest mortality, the highest incidence rates, and one of the higher smoking rates. But if you look in the eastern Appalachian part of the state, the lung cancer incidence rates are in many areas above 130 per 100,000 population. In the United States, it's only 60. And yet our smoking rates are not nearly that much higher. So smoking does not explain all of this. So what we're looking at is why does it remain so intractable and so high in Kentucky? And what we have found is there are other issues. For example, in that particular area with the extraordinarily high lung cancer rates, there are also exposures to arsenic and chromium, which are known carcinogens for lung cancer. So we believe that it's not that smoking isn't an issue, but it's smoking in the presence of some of these other things like arsenic or chromium or radon is another issue in the eastern Appalachian area, that the risks go from about 10 to 11 times that of a non-smoker to as much as 300 times that of a non-smoker.
Where do these elements like arsenic, chromium, and radon come from?
Well, there's a natural geologic layer over the coal beds in Appalachian Kentucky, and so that can be exposed in many ways. The source is a really tricky thing, and we're looking at how exactly does that get into a human being. That's probably the most important source. We also know that there is arsenic and chromium in the bituminous coal that's mined in that area, but it's not clear that that is the main source because there are many people who are not associated in any way with the mines who also have high exposures. So one of the things we're looking at right now is how does that arsenic and chromium get into the human being? The water supply is an easy suspect, but early evidence suggests that may not be the source. So we're working on that question right now.
But as institutions, organizations, businesses begin to go smoking-free, for instance, the campus of Eastern Kentucky University just went completely tobacco-free. That would be 12 days ago.
Congratulations. That's a wonderful step forward.
Now, what does that do then to the risk?
Well, it's the very best thing you can do. If we can help people quit smoking or not start, then these other risk factors will be there, but in the absence of smoking, those other risk factors are not nearly as important or as effective in creating the high rates of lung cancer. The best thing we can do is help people quit smoking, and policy, public policy particularly, has been proven to be a very effective mechanism at helping people avoid not just smoking because it's less convenient, but also exposure to secondhand smoke, which has proven to be a major contributor to lung cancer as well.
You've spoken a bit about the diagnostic tools of mammograms, colonoscopies, and so forth. What about age, weight, gender factors?
Well, all of them are important. As an epidemiologist, I would say all of those are important. But what I want to point out is that age is a factor that will affect all of us. So essentially, everybody gets cancer probably every day, and our immune systems take care of that. They correct that problem. But when the cells of that immune system is damaged in some way and the cell it can't correct the problem, that's when we have this expression of cancer or get a diagnosis of cancer. As you age, your exposure to things that might create that circumstances increases. So I guess if you lived long enough, it's likely that you might encounter some form of cancer. But other things, like weight is obesity has been shown to be an issue with a number of cancers. So those kinds of factors, I think we really have to take into account. But if you really address those issues of trying to have a decent diet and avoiding smoking, you will go a long way. And exercising, which can help keep the weight down. Those things together can really help you avoid a large proportion of the cancers.
Okay, we're going to have Dr. Tucker on the line for the rest of this hour, and we'll be returning to him. And we invite our listeners to consider calling if you have a question, comment, personal story. We certainly want to invite personal stories during today's program because many, many people have been affected by cancer in some way. If you are a survivor, we're interested in hearing from you. And our phone number, 800-621-8890. That's 800-621-8890. You can write to us by email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Send us a tweet at WEKUEST or post on the WEKU Facebook page. In just a few moments, we'll speak with Judy Hewlett and Patsy Catlett of Friend for Life. That phone number once again, 800-621-8890. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. I'm John Hingsbergen. We're talking cancer in the Commonwealth today, and we invite you to get on the line with a story, a question, or a comment, 800-621-8890. That's 800-621-8890, our email address, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Dr. Thomas Tucker with the Department of Epidemiology at the University of Kentucky College of Public Health will be on the line, as well as our guests Judy Hewlett and Patsy Catlett. And Judy is Executive Director of Friend for Life, a Kentucky-based nonprofit based in Louisville?
Yes, that's correct.
Tell us about Friend for Life. Were you involved in the founding?
No, I wasn't. The full name is Friend for Life Cancer Support Network. It was founded by two gentlemen who were introduced by their oncology nurse. They were cancer survivors who recognized the importance of talking to someone who'd been there. Someone who'd been through a cancer experience could understand the overwhelming fears and uncertainties and all just the chaos that your life is thrown into, not only for you, but your loved ones. It was founded in 1988 in Louisville and remains based in Louisville, though we provide support to persons all over.
All over Kentucky or all over the U.S.?
All over the United States and some international support as well. It's a one-on-one network so that a support requester, we will match them with someone who has had the same type of cancer that they have had or that they are facing and the same course of treatment. We match for other factors as well, but primarily those are the most important things we match on. So we make that connection, and from then on, it's a person that you can call on to talk to when you're having a really rough time.
Do they meet face-to-face?
Sometimes they do. If they are living close by and that is something that they would like to do, absolutely.
So in Hawaii, for instance, there would be members of Friend for Life as well as of survivors or patients who need to interact.
Well, currently most of our volunteers, and we call them peer navigators, live in the Louisville area, although we have increasing numbers across the country and a couple international volunteers. But mostly our folks are nearby. They're in Kentucky.
So a lot of that interaction is happening on the phone, online, I would imagine.
On the phone, email, some Skype, yes.
Okay, excellent. Judy, how did you become involved with Friend for Life?
I'm a longtime resident of Louisville, but had lived away for a number of years and was actually looking for employment. And I had gotten my master's in counseling psychology and during that time was diagnosed with breast cancer. So I focused on psychosocial oncology is the name of that particular area, where it's psychology and counseling focused on people dealing with cancer, and ended up volunteering with Friend for Life. I didn't realize they were a staff of one at that time, and then became director in 2000.
So you are a cancer survivor, and you are cancer-free?
Yes, so far as I know.
Congratulations to you as well as to Patsy Catlett, who came with you this morning from Louisville. And Patsy, let's talk about your story, a 16-plus year survivor of stage 3 lung cancer. Am I correct that stage 3 is like the second most serious form of the cancer?
Well, it has a lot to do with the size of the tumor, too. Mm-hmm. Mine was 3B, which is a little bit bigger than just 3. Something not to sneeze at, that's for sure.
Well, tell us about how that occurred for you. You were a smoker.
I was a very heavy smoker, even though I worked in the healthcare field, and like most addicts, in total denial. And in 1998, after being diagnosed with pneumonia, which I probably had, went a little further and found out that it was lung cancer. And got into a very, very aggressive clinical trial. I was lucky enough to be approved for the trial. And I worked at a hospital that did a lot of cancer treatment, so I was surrounded by people I knew and that I trusted, which helped so much. Mm-hmm. And so I was put in a very aggressive treatment. It consisted of 3 rounds of chemotherapy, and after that, surgery. Because it had shrunk the tumor, as hoped, and because it had shrunk the tumor, the only had to take out my upper right lobe instead of the whole lung, which is helpful. Then after the surgery, I had 30 rounds of radiation every day, with one day each week combined with chemotherapy.
Wow! How long did that all take?
7 months.
Talk about getting that diagnosis, what that meant to you, and perhaps, the emotional change that you've gone through. You seem to be very positive and upbeat right now, but I bet it was difficult for a while.
It was. One thing that helps me is I have a very sick sense of humor, and I was managed to hold on to that a little bit. But as I said, I worked in a hospital. I was surrounded by people who knew me and liked me, and I loved them, and nurses, doctors, everybody. And we had so that was a great help. My husband, the very best of him, came out when we were told this, and I just know how lucky I am. I was told I had by the surgeon that my chances of survival were 50-50.
Wow.
And you can take that as a positive thing or a negative thing. I chose to take it as a positive thing. The one thing I will say, and I hope if smokers are listening, that they'll listen to this, and that is all cancer is very, very bad. The thing about lung cancer, if you smoke, is you have the added burden of feeling guilt because you did it to yourself, and now your husband, your children, people who love you, you feel very badly that you have done this to yourself. And I voiced that to my husband, that I felt that way, and that I apologized. And his answer to me was, we don't have time for pity. we've got to get on with it and save our energy for getting you well.
Wow, good guy. Patsy, how did you get involved with Friend for Life? Did you first approach them for services, for,
no,
for support?
No, well, not exactly. Friend for Life's offices are housed on the campus of my hospital where I worked. And I knew about it, and I knew the people that worked over there, never dreaming that I'd ever avail myself of it. But they sort of came after me. They only had one lung cancer survivor at that time. That was 15 years ago. And so I never was a recipient, although I feel like every time I talk to somebody, I'm a recipient. But I was trained quickly, and I'm pretty busy, as Judy knows, because we still don't have very many lung cancer survivors that volunteer. And they're some of the neediest, and I think part of that is what I said about myself. You feel guilty that you've done this to yourself. That comes out quite often.
Well, we'll talk. I guess we'll go further into talking about the experience of working with Friend for Life as a volunteer, supporting other people along the way. But let's get Dr. Thomas Tucker back into the conversation. A couple of survival stories here in the studio today, Dr. Tucker. How typical are these situations?
Well, I think lung cancer survival, I'm just so pleased to hear that. Unfortunately, it's a disease in which the median survival has not changed a lot. It's around 8 months. So to have a long-term survival is a wonderful, positive outcome. Two things have happened with lung cancer. Many things have happened, but two that I can think of right now. One of them is that we're now able to do some genetic testing to determine whether or not and what kinds of chemotherapy might be effective in treating lung cancer patients. The second thing is, until very recently, we've had difficulty finding the disease at an early stage where our treatments can be more effective. Generally, it's found at a more advanced stage, but with the advent of screening, CT screening for lung cancer for at-risk patients, those who smoke, and have a history of smoking, then we have a much better chance of finding that disease at an early phase where our treatments will improve the survival. So that's kind of where we are with lung cancer right now.
Well, any of us of a certain age know that we're supposed to have colonoscopies at regular intervals. For lung cancer, who should be getting screened? Is that something, is there something routine that's going to eventually be something that we should all be taking a part in?
It's really not designed for everyone, and it's not appropriate for everyone. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force has come out with a set of guidelines based on several large clinical trials of spiral CT screening. But essentially, for people who have a history of heavy smoking, they should all be screened. And this could save their life by simply finding the disease at a much earlier stage where our treatments are far more effective. It's actually that simple. Here within Kentucky, collectively, again, many of the hospitals, hospital systems, the large universities, the public health department, the American Cancer Society, the Kentucky Cancer Program, and so on, have come together to try to really promote for appropriate individuals this kind of screening. And we'll see if we can have a major impact on finding this disease at an earlier stage, and then, of course, it'll take a while to see the impact of that on survival.
Can we list briefly those somewhat routine screenings that people should experience? Okay, I'm a male. I've had the colonoscopy. I know about the PSA for prostate cancer. Other factors that men should be aware of, and of course, if they're smokers, obviously they should be concerned about lung cancer,
yeah,
and other lung diseases.
If you're a heavy smoker, talk with your physician about the possibility of being screened, having a CT screening for lung cancer. Certainly colonoscopy for people who are asymptomatic over 50 is very important. And we have a major effort to do that. This can really save people's lives or prevent them from even getting the disease. For women, one of the things that we really want to focus on is cervical cancer. This is a disease where if vaccinated now at a very young age, we can prevent a large proportion of vaccinated against human papillomavirus, which is there's some forms of that which are highly tied to cervical cancer. We can also prevent that disease just like we can in colorectal cancer by continuing to do pap smears at women over the age of 18. So those are really important things. Both men and women should be screened probably annually for skin cancer. Have a dermatologist examine your skin to prevent any of the lesions from getting out of control. Many people will develop basal or squamous cell cancers, which can be easily treated and removed. And you want to be vigilant for the melanomas, which are a little bit more complicated and aggressive. So those are the main things you can do. You should talk to your physician about a PSA. Currently, the Preventive Services Task Force does not necessarily recommend it because there's not evidence that it, in the population studies, reduced mortality. But that's something that each male should talk with his or her, physician about.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. We're talking cancer in the Commonwealth of Kentucky. We invite your stories, your questions, your comments. 800-621-8890. Send us an email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at WEKUEST, and then send us a direct message or post your comment or your message by using Twitter at WEKUEST. You can also go to our Facebook page and post your comment, your question, your personal story. We're interested in hearing these personal stories, of course. Are there cancer survivors in the listening audience? What about a family member? And stories and experiences you would like to share with us, 800-621-8890. Well, let's return to a Friend for Life and Judy Hewlett, Executive Director. The services provided by your organization, the nonprofit, provided totally for free?
Yes, that's right.
And when someone receives a diagnosis of cancer, basically any kind of cancer?
Yes. Right now we have right around 250 volunteers who are survivors of over 50 different types of cancer.
So what should a person who has been diagnosed, how do they approach Friend for Life and get access to your services?
Well, they can contact us a variety of ways. They can call us directly. Am I allowed to give phone numbers?
Oh, sure, absolutely,
like
certainly.
502-893-0643, or toll-free, it's 866-374-3634. Our website is www.friend4life.org.
And actually, if our listeners go to the WEKU website and see the listing for today's program, we put a link there, embedded that in the reference to Friend for Life. So if they, and what we'll do after the show at some point, we'll make sure we get these phone numbers put up there.
Terrific.
As well.
Thank you. So they can contact us because the person recently diagnosed or their caregiver, it's such an emotional time. You feel so overwhelmed that even sometimes making a phone call is different. So it's difficult, excuse me. So we try to make approaching us as easy as possible. So you can send us an email. All that information is on our website. We have a form on our website to request a volunteer. At that point, a staff member will contact that person, get as much information as we feel might be helpful in making a match, and then we will contact one of our volunteers. And our goal is for that contact to be made within 24 hours because a cancer experience is so emotionally, it's a roller coaster, and waiting is a big part of the cancer game, waiting for test results, waiting to get a scan, that sort of thing. So we want to make that connection happen as quickly as possible.
What is your experience with those who receive a cancer diagnosis in terms of their receptivity to getting support? I mean, would a and I guess different personalities react differently, but would a person potentially be wanting to kind of pull within or immediately go out and look for help?
It's as different as every individual. Mm. It truly is. The years I've worked with Friend for Life since 2000, people are just are absolutely unique. And one of the things we like to recognize is that, yes, you have cancer, but you are the same person you've always been, and to honor that individual.
You mentioned caregivers. When a family member or even close friend is diagnosed with cancer, are there things that those others, the non-diagnosed party, can do to help to get these services and help
Absolutely.
Encourage?
We, in fact, we strongly encourage caregivers. I mean, it could be a coworker. If you just want to know how can I be of support, what do I say, what can I do, please give us a call or contact us in some way. We do have a number of caregivers who are willing and able to provide that support because it's a very heavy burden.
Patsy Catlett, before we take another very short break, talk about the range of people you have worked with as a volunteer in terms of interacting with them.
Well, it's a big range. I guess I've worked with... I haven't counted it, but I'm sure I've worked with at least 100, mm-hmm. Probably more. And
not all at once.
Not all the same day, no. But however, sometimes you will have more than one client at a time that you're working with. And the range is, for me, from my experience, has been sometimes people just want a couple of non-medical questions answered, and you can provide that to them, and that's all they want. Other people will periodically want you to call them and just talk and walk them through what they're experiencing, all the way up to some people stay in your life if they survive. I don't have a lot of survivors because it's lung, but I do have some, and they're extraordinary people.
So the volunteers are matched up, paired up with people of the similar cancer experience.
As close as possible, yes.
We're going to take a short break and return to our discussion of cancer in the Commonwealth on Eastern Standard. Patsy Catlett is a 16-plus-year survivor of stage 3 lung cancer and a volunteer with Friend for Life. Judy Hewlett, Executive Director of Friend for Life, also a cancer survivor, a breast cancer survivor. And Dr. Thomas Tucker, Founding Chair of the Department of Epidemiology at the University of Kentucky's College of Public Health. Your questions, your comments, your stories invited, 800-621-8890. We're going to talk to Glenn from Corbin in a few moments. We'd love to hear from you. Email us, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. That phone number, 800-621-8890. Eastern Standard is our program and our topic this week, cancer in the Commonwealth and support for cancer survivals, positive approaches as opposed to, I know, Patsy, you talked about a 50-50 chance of survival when you were diagnosed with lung cancer. The glass is either half full or it's half empty. You chose to take the half full approach.
With a lot of help.
And we're interested in hearing from our listeners who have experience with cancer or questions about cancer. Dr. Thomas Tucker is on the line as well, and Judy Hewlett here as well with answers to your questions, hopefully, or at least the ability to react to your comment. 800-621-8890. Let's talk to Glenn from Corbin. Thanks for calling, Glenn. Go right ahead.
Hi. So I just wanted to call in. I recently graduated from medical school, and I was driving through on my way to start residency up in Ohio, and I just wanted to call in and comment. First, congratulations on your survival story, Patsy. That's really inspiring. And Dr. Tucker, a comment that you made earlier about smoking and the other insults that can happen to one's body from other sources, I just wanted to reiterate that if you quit smoking, it will help your body fight the other cancer-causing etiologies much better. So part of the two-hit theory, where if you got one thing that's predisposing you to cancer and you're smoking or doing something else that can be carcinogenic or cancer-causing, it really increases your risk of developing that cancer substantially. So... And the benefits of smoking cessation are almost immediate. It's just trying to reiterate that point and hopefully help some people that are teetering on the edge of quitting smoking that, you know, this is really a good opportunity for you to sit there and think about it scientifically, think about it emotionally even, think about your family and what you're doing for yourself as well as for others.
So Glenn, some of us grew up in an age when we would go to the doctor's office and the doctor might have smoked a cigarette before he stepped in to visit the patient. How has that changed in the medical profession? What kind of perceptions did you find in medical school of smoking among medical students?
You will not find many medical professionals smoking beyond that of those who are, I suppose, in higher octane situations, if you will, more adrenaline rush, stressful situations. But generally speaking, it's kind of like the third rail in the healthcare community. If you're smoking, it's generally frowned upon because, you know, it's bad for you and it's also setting a bad example. Back in the, 60s, Dr. Johnson smoked Marlboros because mm-hmm. it helped you breathe better.
Yep.
Which, everybody knows that's absolutely not true. It's very much frowned upon.
Glenn, thank you for your call. Let's get a reaction from Dr. Thomas Tucker, Ph.D. Dr. Tucker?
Glenn, thank you so much for your comments and for really reiterating the point that one of the best things you can do for your health if you smoke is quit smoking. And as you pointed out, quitting has almost immediate benefits, both for you and for anyone you might live with or be around. So it's one of the things we can do. Smoking, being screened at age eligible and appropriate intervals, watching your diet and exercising, those things are things you have control over. And if you can do those or find help to do those, you'll have great benefit from them.
Okay, Glenn, thanks again for your call to Eastern Standard at 800-621-8890. In a moment, we'll talk to Ed from Lexington. But Dr. Tucker, Dr. Glenn talked about the issues of smoking and smoking cessation. Secondhand smoke, certainly an issue in airplanes, certainly an issue in close office environments, certainly an issue in restaurants. What about I'm thinking of a campus such as Eastern Kentucky University going completely tobacco-free. There used to be some shelters outside where people could go to smoke, or signs, don't smoke any closer than 25 feet from the door. What's the problem with somebody just smoking right outside the door or in a special shelter?
Well, the University of Kentucky as well went smoke-free several years ago as a campus. And as you point out, used to have these areas where people could, enclosed areas actually, where people could smoke. Unfortunately, that's concentrating their exposure both to the cigarettes they're inhaling and the secondhand smoke that's captured in that environment. So that's extraordinarily unhealthy. And those have pretty much been abandoned. I don't think that's really a good idea. The second thing is the secondhand smoke exposure, if you're by yourself in an open-air area, may not affect someone else, but again, it's affecting you. And so there really are no reasons to continue to smoke. If we can help encourage people not to start or help them quit once they have started, the benefits are so, so extraordinary. It's probably the single most important thing we could do. So I guess what I would say is it may be possible for you not to affect anybody else if you go out in a field on a windy day and smoke a cigarette. Hopefully you can't light it, but and smoke a cigarette, but it's not going to help you. So I would just encourage people not to start, and if they have, to get some help to quit.
Would a good rule of thumb be if you can smell it, You're getting some of that tobacco in your lungs?
Absolutely.
All right. This is Eastern Standard. 800-621-8890 is our phone number. Let's go to Ed from Lexington. Ed, thanks for calling. Go right ahead. Hello, Ed. You're on the air.
Hello.
Yes, go right ahead, Ed.
My exposure to the cancer situation came about 5 years ago when my mother was diagnosed with lung cancer. And the doctor told her that she had 4 months to live. She actually lived 2 years. The four-month prognosis was devastating to her emotionally. But what my family went through, we didn't know what to do. We didn't know what to expect. We were really struggling to find unbiased counselors that could help us through the process. Eventually, 2 years later, she passed away. That's 3 years ago. But what I learned was is that the family of the cancer patient has a lot of very, very difficult decisions to help the patient make. And they're really, I hate to say this, but cancer is an industry, and a lot of people, it's hard to get counseling that's not based on a stream of revenue. That's a terrible thing to say, but that's what we found to be the case.
It's important to raise
anyway,
that issue.
I don't know where you'd go to find quality counseling that did not have a financial bias.
We're going to ask Judy Hewlett for a response. I'm so sorry to hear about your mother and your experience. And maybe we'll talk a little bit about the medical profession. And actually, stay on the line here, Glenn. I'm wondering if maybe you would even have some advice for doctors, if having experience with them. Let's just do that first, then we can let you go. But did you have experiences with doctors where they could have done a little better job in terms of their interaction or their what is called bedside manner?
Oh, absolutely. We could have used some bedside manner, and we also, I think some of the procedures really didn't accomplish anything except running up some huge bills. And, she was... They did medical procedures on her when the end was inevitable, and all it caused was increased pain and suffering, and unfortunately for our country, huge Medicare bills, and didn't really help her quality of life, or there was no real hope. It was just more medicine.
Okay. Ed, thank you so much. We're going to let you go, and we're going to ask Judy to respond to that initial question about where do you get reliable help?
Ed, you expressed that so well, and I'm so sorry for what you went through. That is actually a very important topic now with the National Cancer Institute, the larger organizations that provide cancer care, because they're really looking, especially with the Affordable Care Act, that we've got to look at the importance of what's appropriate treatment, when are we just extending that person's life without recognizing quality of life. But that is something Friend for Life could be a resource for the family, is a resource for the family. We don't give medical advice, but we can be there to help you sort through those decision processes. Another thing that we do that hopefully is leading toward better communication between physicians, nurses, social workers, and patients and families is that every year our volunteers will go meet with the University of Louisville Medical School, Nursing School, and School of Social Work, in addition to a couple of others, and have conversations with first-year students, sometimes they're more advanced, about this is what it's like to go through cancer, and this is what it meant when I spoke with my doctor, and this is how we can make it better. So there are some very important conversations that we're having, and have done that since 2007.
We have a number of callers waiting on the line, so we'll try to get to everyone that we can here, especially with some of these very compelling and interesting stories. Tammy from Lancaster, thanks for being on the line with us. Tammy, go right ahead.
Thank you. My mother was diagnosed in 2006 with pancreatic cancer, and I lived with her for a year as a caregiver. She was 54 at the time. She is coming up on her eighth year as a survivor. And I guess the reason that I wanted to call was I had been told, by two different doctors that she was not going to live. And I understand the scope of their knowledge and the test and things. She did survive. She had something called a Whipple procedure. And when people that I face and they're facing cancer, what I tell them is, one, take a notebook with you to every doctor's appointment. Write down what they say. You hear it when it's happening, but you don't comprehend it.
How about taking a friend or family member?
Exactly. Well, I was that person for her, and I was, kind of alone for some of them. But the doctors, they would spell the words, it was just a wonderful experience for me. And then there's other aspects like keep track of your mileage to doctor's offices, you know, your medical expenses, everything for your taxes. Nobody thinks of that when it's going on. You know, it's just my approach was analytical because that was just the only way I could deal with it. And, you know, she survived. So I'm so thankful to hear about this organization. She moved in with me 2 years ago, and she now takes care of my five-year-old, and that is full-time employment. But I'll be telling her about this organization, and I'm going to get involved in it myself. So I just appreciate the story very much.
Okay, very positive nods from both Judy and Patsy here in reaction to your very upbeat story. Congratulations and on your mother's survival and apparently overcoming pancreatic cancer. This is Eastern Standard. Let's go to the phone now and talk to Tom from Tennessee. Tom, go right ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, this is Tom. I'm calling in. I'm a cancer survivor with mantle cell lymphoma. I was diagnosed in 2012. Are you there?
Yes, yes. Tell us about that. How's that gone for you? Are you cancer free?
Well, I understand it's still considered to be a terminal cancer, although I was lucky enough to get into a study over at Vanderbilt, and they their approach seems to work. There were five of us that went through, and only one didn't make it, and it didn't seem to make any difference what they did for her, but the other four of us are, up to this point in time, I understand, still doing quite well. I was going to comment a little bit about attitude as a, you know, somebody who went through this, that the treatments were pretty severe for my case. I just took it as I felt like I was an observer going through this, just watching the different things and participating, although I could think of a thousand different things I'd rather do than go through cancer treatment, I try to make the best of it, you know.
So you're saying your attitude has helped you
make
it through?
Yeah, I think so. I think it can really help.
What contributed to that attitude? Is it just the optimistic nature, spirituality, support of family and friends, loved
I
ones?
Think all that. Certainly, my lifelong faith helped quite a bit, but I generally have a pretty optimistic outlook. And for some reason, I've always had this feeling that things were going to work out fairly well. You know, even if it ended up I would die early. I think that those things that you mentioned are pretty critical. And if you need help, if this is what the show is about, is getting that sort of help, then by all means, jump in, because I think your attitude can have a profound impact.
Excellent. Well, Tom, thank you. Thanks for being here with us, and thanks for sharing your story, and all the best to you. Let's quickly see. We're not going to be able to talk to Charles, I don't think, but let's talk to Scott from Frankfurt. Very briefly, Scott, with your story of survival.
Yes, sir. I was diagnosed with stage 4 kidney cancer in April of 2010. And initially was given a 3 months to live diagnosis, and I sort of in line with what the previous caller was saying, I refused to accept that. But the real point that I want to make is that my disease is being treated now as a chronic illness, and I think there are probably a number of cancers that are ultimately probably not totally curable, in which those of us who are patients and I continue to take a certain type of therapy, you know, it's not exactly the same as traditional chemotherapy, but I do that once a week, and so I've had a very good quality of life.
So it's a matter of managing the cancer.
Pardon me?
It's a matter of managing the disease.
Well, you know, and I had a positive attitude, and I really am proactive in taking control of all aspects of the things that I can can control.
Scott, I'm very sorry that we are about out of time, so I'm going to have to stop you right there. I'm really grateful you made the effort to call in, and congratulations on what you're accomplishing there with your own survival. Very briefly, we have time for our guests, a few more comments. Very quickly, Charles from Lexington wanted to know why there are no laws against smoking in cars with children. Anybody have any ideas about that? Dr. Tucker, for instance.
Well, I think there may be in some other states. I know that's a topic that's beginning to come to the surface in policymaking discussions in other parts of the country, and there may actually be laws in place in some places.
Okay. Well, Dr. Tucker, why don't you, in 20 seconds or so, give us again a brief comment in terms of what you recommend for people who in terms of prevention and survival.
Well, I think taking care of yourself, not smoking, diet, and watching your diet and exercising are probably the best things you can do. I do think a positive attitude, positive outlook makes a huge difference in all of our lives for all kinds of things, not just cancer.
Okay. Well, so let me get from Judy Hewlett one more time the phone number and the web address, because we are 30 seconds away.
Yes, 502-893-0643. And www.friend4life.org.
Okay, Judy Hewlett and Patsy Catlett of Friend for Life, thank you both for being here. Thank you for Dr. Thomas Tucker of the Department of Epidemiology at the University of Kentucky. This is Eastern Standard. Thanks to Jonice Franklin, who's been at the controls, Julie Tennell on the phones, and Richard Turner produced this week's show. More information about the organization and this show, weku.fm.